Hey guys, welcome to Mercy Hill. My name is Andrew. I'm one of the pastors here at Mercy Hill. And man, excited you came out with us tonight. I know it's a tough time of year, a busy time of year, but we're excited to worship with you tonight. I hope that you were able to come to our Christmas gathering last week. I hope, man, many of y'all were able to be there. It was pretty awesome, and it was awesome for a few different reasons. Man, one was that we got a chance to worship all together. And I had a few people come up to me afterwards and just say, like, you know, seeing everybody together, I always come to this service or come to this service. And I didn't realize, like, what God has been doing when you see everybody together and see how he truly has been adding to our number daily. I mean, honestly, since we moved, you know, moved here about a year ago or launched our church about a year ago. The other thing that was so amazing to me is that, man, everything that God has been doing for us and in us and through us at Mercy Hill, I thought was evidenced by our services last week. And the reason is because 18 months ago, I was sitting at a meeting. We were just new in Greensboro, about 30 people going to try to plant a church in Greensboro. And a guy looked across the table at me and he said, "Hey man, what do y'all have, like, worship gear-wise, people-wise? Do you have, like, a worship leader? Do y'all have, like, lights, all this stuff?" I said, "Bro, we have a laptop and I have a pickup truck. That's what we have." That's it. 18 months ago, that's exact all that we had. That's all that was. Nobody to play music, nobody to do lights, nobody to do anything, and to see what God has done in 18 months in order to bring people around us, both believers and non-believers that have come to Christ at Mercy Hill, to be able to worship God in the way that we were last week. So anyway, I just wanted to say, man, we're excited about that. And maybe you came last week, it was your first time, and now you're here. We're excited that you're here. And we're just going to continue to dive into the series that we're in, which is the series called The Word in the book of John. And so I'll go ahead and invite you guys now, if you have a copy of Scripture, go ahead and take it out and turn with me to John chapter 1. We're going to be diving into the next part of this series as we look at the first 18 verses of John's gospel, all right? I was thinking about it this week, and, you know, I really think that if I wasn't from the United States of America, the weirdest thing about Americans would be all the stuff that we do for Christmas. I mean, it would have to be. If you look in at what people do in the United States of America for Christmas, it is all totally bizarre. I mean, if you think about driving by and you see little baby Jesus in a manger, and then, you know, the lights beside him are like lit up palm trees, and you're like, I don't know really what's happening with that. You hear Silent Night on the radio, and then the next song is Elvis singing Blue Christmas, and you're just like, I'm not really sure what to make of any of this. I started asking our staff, I said, "Hey, what are some of the weird things about Christmas?" And they just started naming them off: flying reindeer, presents in socks hanging by the fireplace, grown men wearing footed pajamas, 21 million Christmas trees sold annually. Some people said elves were weird, just in general, okay? Fruitcake, the seven dancing women in the song 12 Days of Christmas is pretty strange. Claymation. I mean, if you've seen any of the Claymation movies growing up, our parents thought they were so great. They're terrifying. The little dudes running around. I asked Bobby, our executive pastor, I said, "Hey man, what do you think is the weirdest thing about Christmas?" He didn't bat an eye, not even blink. He said, "The weirdest thing about Christmas by far is the exact nature of the relationship between Santa and Mrs. Claus." I said, "I don't even know what you mean by that." But it's weird. The whole thing's weird. Everything's weird. The Grinch is weird. The Griswolds are weird. The only thing that we get right about Christmas, it seems like, is the gift giving. Now, here's where I'm going with this, all right? I don't mean like the hysteria of gift giving. I don't mean like people lining up at Target on Thanksgiving night. That's not what I mean. But I mean the idea of being excited about giving someone a gift actually parallels Christmas, does it not? I mean, I don't know how the Grinch plays in. I don't know how like the palm trees that are lit up play in. But I know how the gift giving plays in. The joy of a father giving, you know, gifts to his children. As a dad now, I have two kids. I know that giving gifts to our kids is so much more fun than getting gifts. My little girl is getting, don't tell her, okay, but she's getting a stuffed animal monkey that she wants so bad. And she has been walking around the house writing down all the things that she's going to do with the monkey. They're going to play together. They're going to do all this. She can't wait. I can't wait to give it to her. My little boy is going to get miniature Carhartt overalls, which are going to be awesome, you know? I can't wait to, as a father, I want to give gifts to my kids. This parallels what we see at Christmas pretty well. The joy over a gift, because At Christmas time, what we see is the greatest gift that was ever given, the ultimate gift, the gift of the Word becoming flesh. Church, we have been giving the ultimate gift. God Himself has given us God Himself in the nature of a man in order that we might be in relationship with Him once again, that this broken world might be put back together. Christians in the room tonight, I think there are unspeakable riches that are hard for us to mine because we've heard it our whole lives about what Christmas means, and we know we're supposed to know the reason for the season and all of this. When we begin to think about the incarnation tonight, there's unspeakable riches there. Our salvation is there. Our mission is there. I hope we'll be awakened to that again, afresh and anew tonight. And for some of you that aren't Christians, you're coming, man, you're checking things out. If you're not a believer, I hope that there'll be something new for you to see in tonight's message in John chapter 1. Because for you, God may honestly be a concept that is out there, pie in the sky, up there, out there, somewhere. But the reality is, that is not the biblical view of God. God isn't out there somewhere. He was a man on this earth, taking the form of a man on this earth in order that he might walk the road that you and I have failed to walk. God's ultimate revelation is in this divine man. I hope that you will see him, maybe even meet him tonight, all right? John chapter 1, I am going to spend our time tonight talking about one phrase out of one verse. And then next week we'll finish the verse. It's one of the most rich verses in the New Testament, certainly one of the most popular phrases in the New Testament. John chapter 1, verse 14, our passage for tonight is this, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Christianity teaches, the Bible teaches, that Jesus Christ actually, truly, really, literally was a man on this earth. That the Son of God, the Word, if you've been walking with us in this series, you know that John has taken this idea of the Word, looking at the Bible and realizing that God speaks through His Word, that He reveals Himself through His Word, that He communicates with His people through His Word, that He heals by His Word, He saves by His Word. And when he sees Jesus on the earth, the full revelation of all that God is, he says, the Word. The Word is the Son of God, one of the three persons of the Trinity, fully divine. This is the Word, but He has become flesh. Christianity teaches that the divine, this Word, literally became flesh, became a human. You guys know me. If you've been listening to my preaching, one of my pet peeves is when people use the word literally wrongly, okay? It bothers me to no end. The show Parks and Recreation now on TV. I never really watched the show or anything like that. One of the guys is catching heat in news articles from all these grammarian people that are saying they are destroying the English language because one of the guy's jokes, he always uses the word literally, but he means it figuratively. And this is how languages are destroyed. People say this all the time. It drives me nuts. People will say, like a college kid might say, "Hey, this class is so hard. I can't even get my mind. I literally can't wrap my head around the class." And I'm like, yes, that's physically impossible, okay? To literally wrap your head around. People say, "Oh, the movie was so funny. Man, I was dying laughing. I literally died laughing." When I say literally became a man, John 1, 14, the Word became flesh, I don't mean figurative literally. I mean literally. Actually became a man. Walked on this earth. This is who we celebrate. Jesus became a man, and he did so in a way that is really talked about throughout the entire Bible. This is a biblical concept. It's not a one-verse concept. It's not an obscure passage that I'm pulling out. If you read the New Testament, this is what you find. You find verses like this. Romans chapter 1, verse 3 and 4. "Concerning his son, who was descended from David according to the flesh." Son of God, talking about according to the flesh. 1 John 4, 2. "By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God." 2 John verse 7. "For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is a deceiver and the Antichrist." What you look at when you look at the New Testament is this idea of Jesus coming, the Son of God coming in the flesh, is a very, very biblical one. What I want to do for just a minute is try to explain to you what that looks like in Jesus' life. It's a little bit of theology here, but I think it's very important that we understand when Jesus says, when John says, Jesus, the Word has become flesh, what does he mean by that? Here's what he means. John is taking a concept that you find in the Old Testament, and he is playing off of it. He's saying, hey, in the Old Testament, we have this idea of God dwelling amongst his people in the tabernacle. The people move around, they do all this stuff, but they have this tabernacle. God meets with them there. His presence is there. That's where he is. He's playing off of that analogy. Now he is looking at Jesus in the world, and he is saying, God dwells with his people now in Jesus. The full revelation of what the tabernacle pointed us to and pushed us to is among us. The full revelation of God, Jesus Christ, he is dwelling in this tent. I think about Jesus, you know, he gets this rap of being like this granola, Chacos wearing, REI loving type of guy. Well, it turns out the tent analogy from REI is actually pretty good. Because it's almost like he has pitched a tent on this earth among his people. That is Jesus Christ. He is a divine man. He is dwelling fully with his people. The human race has now seen God enter, not just physically, but has entered the race of humankind. He is a divine man, but of course that's the trouble, isn't it? How is a man divine, or how can the divine be man? Maybe you're here tonight, you've looked at this a little bit, maybe you're like, hey, this is one of the parts of Christianity that I just don't understand. Many times we just have to take it for what it is, we have to look at it. If you really want to study this, I would push you to a couple of classic Christian works, one by a guy named Athanasius called On the Incarnation, another by a guy named Anselm, a book called Why God Became Man. But the very basic idea that you will find when you actually begin to look at what it means that the Word becomes flesh is that the person of the Son of God with a nature that is divine takes on a human nature in the world. And now we have Jesus Christ, who is one person in two natures. Not like us. We have one nature. Jesus has two natures. A human nature that is fully human, but yet doesn't cease to have a divine nature. I think at this point, when we're looking at this, we're tempted to kind of go the analogy route. We're tempted to say, well, it's kind of like this. No, it's not. It's not like anything. If we learned anything from when we talked about the Trinity a few weeks ago or a month ago or whatever, we don't explain things in the Bible by analogy. We explain them by saying, what is it? This is what it is. Jesus ain't like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Like he's like two different types of person, but in the same, nope. It's not kind of like us where we're like, hey, there's times where I feel like there's times I'm really sanctified, there's times I'm really sinful. Nope. It's not like those things. It's not like anything. What it's like is my favorite phrase in all the English language, which is, it is what it is. That's it. That's what we see. Now, you look back through church history, you're going to find a bunch of guys who didn't take that at face value. They kept pushing on it, and they fell into heresy. A guy named Apollinarius, he believed that Jesus was clothed in the flesh but had no soul. A guy named Nestorius, he believed that there was two natures to Christ, like I've said, human nature, divine nature, but therefore he saw two Jesuses, two natures, two persons. Wrong. Eutychus, guy who saw Christ as being two natures, but had them melded together and blended together. Yeah, two natures, but you can't decipher which is which, and they're all almost like a Jesus blender, like a Jesus juice diet is kind of his idea. Wrong. The Docetists believe, hey, Jesus is only appearing to be in the flesh, but really he is just spirit. All stemming from a false idea that anything that would be flesh would have to necessarily be bad. What they've missed is that God has made us into whole people, both body and spirit. Sometimes we, by accident, begin to believe this. If you ever begin to think to yourself, like, man, one day someone, you know, someone that's older or whatever, one day they're just going to be freed and be out and shirk this prison of a shell of a body and finally be the spirit that they were longing to be. We don't realize it, but that's heretical. That's not Christianity. Christianity is not the Docetists that believe, oh, the spirit is good. The divine would never touch the physical. No, we are whole people. Now, I can keep going on with this list. All heresy. It is what it is. The truth is that Jesus And Jesus came, and his nature never ceased to be divine, but he took on human nature in what we get as Jesus Christ. Jesus was fully God and fully man. He was the God-man with two natures that were joined in a miraculous union in one person. That's what it is. All right, now, that's the explanation. When you say, what does it mean that the Word became flesh? That's what it means. That's who Jesus is. But what does it mean for us, right? Well, I think for us tonight, it means two pretty big things. I'm going to give them both to you right here, okay? The two things are this that I want us to see. Pretty simple. The incarnation, that's the Word becoming flesh. The incarnation shows God's mission to us, and the incarnation shows God's mission through us. To us and through us. Let's look at the first one. The incarnation shows God's mission to us. Understanding the incarnation, like I'm talking about, with, hey, two natures, one person, God never ceasing to be God, but assuming, you know, assuming the nature of a man and all this stuff is good to know, and maybe it's like good to have in your mind, and maybe you have all this knowledge now that if you go to a dinner party over Christmas, you can like begin to talk about theology with people and all of that, but none of it really matters unless we know why. Like, yeah, Jesus came, two natures, one person, incarnation, but why? The Bible is very clear. Two verses that talk about Jesus coming in the flesh as the Son, but also giving us the reason why. Romans chapter 8, verse 3 says this, "For God has done what the law, weakened by the flesh, could not do. By sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh." Jesus comes in the flesh. Why? For our salvation. Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. "When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons." Jesus coming, two natures, one person, assuming flesh, incarnation, all of that's great. But what we get is that the reason for all of these things is that he has come for our salvation. Jesus came to save us because we needed a savior. I am not a Greek scholar, okay? But I go to a lot of, I know how to pick out a very competent, well-respected commentary of people who are Greek scholars. I can point you to any credible commentary you want to go to. They're all going to make a point. Here's the point. John, in his Greek, makes a point about Jesus coming in the flesh that is blunt. That's like in your face. Like language that we typically may not use. Trying to get at this idea of like even the flesh, low down, dirty, everything that goes, Jesus has come in this form, very blunt. John is trying to get us to see, he's saying something in a way that a Southerner wouldn't say it. A Southerner beats around the bush, you know, they don't want to say what they actually mean. They want to kind of get around and maybe hint around and all that. Nope, he's saying it like someone from the North, okay? They're going to tell it like it. This is it. This is what I mean. I got three words for you, that's it. That's kind of how John does it. Why? He's trying to get us to see that Jesus has come in the flesh. Jesus has come as a human because it is humanity that stands condemned. He wants us to see that Jesus comes as a human in order to save humans because it is humanity that needs salvation. This is what we don't really understand. Jesus comes as a human to save humans. You say, okay, I get that. What did I need salvation for? You need salvation for being a fallen human. For being a human now that has fallen, that has sinned in Adam and chosen against God, that very thing that you are, not for an act you did or something, I'm talking about who you are, you, me. Jesus comes as a human to save us from the fallen part of that which we are. Now, I know that's a little bit complicated. Let me try to break it down, okay? There's an aspect of this that is very simple and an aspect of this that is a little more theological and a little more deeper. The aspect of this that is very simple is just the fact that every single one of us knows, yeah, we need Jesus to come maybe for the things that we have done wrong in our life. We get that. You do the crime, you do the time, that kind of thing. We understand that. We watch kids, we watch people around us. We know when we do something wrong. We know that we need, you know, maybe your stuff about Jesus is whatever, but you know that when you've done something wrong, you know when you're caught. I saw a pretty interesting story the other day. Hey, dude, can you give me a glass of water? Sorry, bro, I'm like struggling. Sorry. I saw a story the other day that came out of New Bern, North Carolina. something that happened at a Piggly Wiggly, okay? Typically, it's a very interesting way to start a story. Newburn, North Carolina, happened in October at the Piggly Wiggly. Woman rides up. She gets out. She walks up to the drink machine. She puts her money in to get a 7-Up. The drink machine don't give her a 7-Up. Now, we don't exactly know what transpired next. We don't know if she shook the machine. We don't know if, maybe, thanks, bro. We don't know if she shook the machine. We don't know if maybe there was some tipping of the machine going on. What we do know is that she went home and got a can of gas and set the machine on fire. Okay. That part is pretty clear. The police come. She walks right up to them, turns herself in, exact quote. She said, when it goes to court, I'll represent myself because I'm guilty. She said, I don't need a lawyer to lie for me because I'm going to tell you that I done it. That's an exact quote, okay? That part of sin, we get. We get the part that says, hey, I messed up. And, you know, I know, and maybe you, know, you may not even be a Christian or whatever, but you understand the part of like, hey, I know that I messed up. My kid knows when it's messed up. We know that when we have messed up, there's a deeper and theological meaning that is going on here about why Christ has come in the flesh. Did he come to redeem that, your sinful acts? Yes. But did he come to redeem something more than that, which is who you are? The humanity that we all share, is that something that he has come to redeem because it has fallen? Yes. See, there's an aspect of this that we don't really understand, and it's this. We are held accountable, yes, for the sins that we have committed, but there's an aspect to sin that we don't think about very much, and it is the aspect of sin that is inherent to us as humans. The condemnation that has come from ultimately from our father way back from Adam, who stood in on our behalf. As Adam sinned against God, the entire human race has sinned against God and fallen away. Every single person on earth as a member of the human race has inherited sin from our parents, specifically from Adam. Now, I've got some scripture that we're going to read about this, right? Romans chapter 5, verse 12. It's going to be up here. Then we're going to read a bigger passage in just a minute. But this is what the Bible is getting at when it says this. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned. Death reigns in the world. The world is broken. We are broken. The world is cursed. We are cursed. We are condemned, yes, for the sin that you have committed in your life. But not only that, there is also condemnation that we inherit from being humans. In some sense, there is sin that is passed down from our fathers, something wrapped up in fallen human condition. What it means to be a human, there is something fallen in that and sinful in that. Maybe you never thought about it. Why is it such a big deal that Jesus is born of a virgin? That's not just like a cool part of the Christmas story. That's not just like part of the Christmas card. Jesus is born of a virgin. It is significant in our life because being born of a virgin means that Jesus doesn't inherit Adam's sin in the way that you and I do. It means that, you know, Jesus, I mean, when Adam was born, if you will, when he was created, if you will, he stood before God without sin. No one has done that since as Adam stood in on behalf of us all. And as he sinned, we have all sinned. Jesus, not from the line of Adam, specifically from his father, is born and this baby comes into the world and he is not condemned for this fallen humanity. The gift to the world is this. The gift to the world is a second chance through Jesus. The gift to the world is, can this Adam, this second Adam, Jesus Christ, do what the first Adam failed to do? To live before God without sin in a perfect relationship. If this were a movie when Christ is born, this is, if everything that's ever happened in the world is played out on a movie screen, when Christ is born, this is when everyone sits up on the edge of their seat. Why? Because there's a chance. The baby that is laying in a manger has a chance of growing up and standing in on behalf of people again in the way that Adam did, but doing it for our righteousness and for our good, not for our condemnation. This is why Jesus is the hero of every story and the point of every sermon at Mercy Hill Church. Because as the divine man comes into the world kind of holds its breath. Christmas is not a big deal because there's a baby born. Christmas is a big deal because there is a chance for a champion to bring redemption into the world for us all. And he came through. Jesus never sinned. He lived before God, perfect in every way, comes to the end of his life, and while he should reap reward, he chooses the cross and death that you and I might have the reward. Jesus gives his life in order that you and I might be able to have life. It's faith in this Jesus, and faith in what he did, and faith in why he has done it, that brings us life, that he seals for us in his resurrection. You know, there's a story told about Jesus in Luke chapter 18. Many of you know, man, at Mercy Hill, we love kids. We push people to have kids, have a bunch of kids, put them in our kids program. We love kids. They all run around here, man. After the service, they're running around grabbing stuff, running up here. My little kids are the ones that are tearing stuff up. I mean, they're everywhere. It's a good thing. It's a blessing. But it can be kind of annoying, you know? I mean, it's hard. Because let's say you're trying to do something real serious. You're trying to do something very, and the kids are all just running around. The disciples react to the kids in Luke 18 in a lot of ways that probably we would react to the kids. And they say, go on. Go. We're trying to do something serious here. And Jesus says a famous quote. Maybe if you got Sunday school way back in your background or something, the old King James version of the Bible, Jesus says, suffer not the little ones to come to me. Jesus is showing us something. He's saying, hey, these little ones, they're the ones that truly get it. They've seen what I have done. They have seen the mission that that I have come, and they're just placing childlike faith in me. Not that they're coming to me to stand in a line so they can sit on my lap and tell me how naughty and nice they've been in order that I might give them something. That's not their faith. Their faith is that they're coming to me. They're seeing that I have been on mission for them, that I have given them a great gift, something that we all ought to get. That's what Romans 5 gets at. You ready? Here's the long passage that I was going to tell you. Romans chapter 5, it makes this so abundantly clear, explicitly clear. It's a long passage. Just follow with me. The free gift is not like the trespass. What it's saying is, as Jesus has come in as the second Adam, he has given us something that isn't like what Adam gave us. In Adam, we all get death. Jesus has given us something else. For if many die through the one man's trespass, much more will have the grace of God and the free gift by the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. And the free gift is not like the result of that one man's sin. For the judgment following one trespass brought condemnation, but the free gift following many trespasses brought justification. For if because of one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man, much more will be those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. Therefore, as one trespass led to condemnation for all men, so one act of righteousness leads to justification and life for all men. For as by the one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners, so by the one man's obedience, the many will be made righteous. Adam gave us death. The second Adam gives us life. This is the mission of God to us. Jesus becomes a human, the second Adam, in order to save what is wrong with you. That in your fallenness, who you are, the humanity itself, this is what Jesus has come. He's become a human in order to save humanity. If your concept of Christianity is that Jesus is a philosopher or something like that in order to help us live better lives, that's just not biblical. What we see from the Bible is if I wanted to think about the theologian Watchman Nee, he would explain it like this. He would say, hey, it isn't that Jesus has come to make you better. It's that Jesus has come in the flesh in order to remove you. He comes in the flesh to crucify the flesh that you might die and then be raised new. You're gone. There's a new you. This is what Jesus has come to do. What we need to see is that God's mission to us, his incarnation, the flesh that he takes on, it is to heal what is, this is my question to you, all right? What is it in your life right now that is most wrong with you? What is it? Whatever that is, Jesus has come to save and heal that. This is why he comes in the flesh. Whatever it is, loneliness, emptiness, depression, temper. Jesus come, all of these things stem from your humanity. Jesus has come to save your fallen humanity. Cancer, AIDS, paralysis, MS. Jesus has come to heal these things in you, whether it be in this life or in the kingdom that is to come. Addiction, sexual sin, dishonesty, gluttony. What is it that is most wrong with you? This is why Jesus became a man. Becomes a human to save humans from their fallen humanity. Church, that's love. If we want to see God's love to us, it is not primarily wrapped up in a sunrise or a mountain range or a beach. God's love to us is seen in a man willing to take on all that is wrong in order that he might heal all that is wrong. The famous quote that came out of this period in church history is, whatever Jesus hasn't assumed, he hasn't healed. Well, good news is that as Jesus come in, he is a 100% man, and he has assumed all that it means to be a man, and therefore he has healed all that is wrong with humanity. That's the incarnation and God's mission to us, all right? But like I said, there's two parts to this. The incarnation shows God's mission to us. The incarnation shows God's mission through us. We see God's mission to us, but that mission to us teaches us something about God's mission through us. What happened for us in the world, what happened when Jesus comes into the world, and what happens to us as Christ saves us, is not something that just happens to us. It is something that models for us what ought to be happening through us. All right? Now look, I'm going to give you kind of a weird example of this, but if you follow me, it makes sense, okay? I don't know if any of you guys have any friends that are police officers. I have a couple friends that are cops. One of my friends is a cop is in South Carolina. In the state of South Carolina, maybe everywhere, but I know there, if you're going to carry a taser, you have to be tased, all right? So if you're a cop and you said, hey, I want to carry a taser, you actually have to be tased. And they videotape it for your friends and family. I got to watch the video of my buddy Jay. Apparently, when you get tased, it's pretty much a four-step process. Taser, you stiffen, you squeal, you drop. Okay? That's what happened. Boom, tased them. Now, this is the analogy, all right? Do you have to get tased in order to really know how to pull the trigger on the taser? Do you have to physically be tased in order to kind of get the nuts and bolts of what it looks like? No? I mean, not really get the nuts and bolts. But you need to be tased in order to fully understand what it means to tase someone else. Is that right? To fully understand what it means when I pull the trigger and hit you, I pretty much need to go through that experience myself. The incarnation to us, God's mission to us, it does something in our lives that shows us how that we are incarnated in a sense in order to be on mission for the world. What we have seen God doing to us is something that we now see God do through us. We understand it more fully after we have experienced it, but now we see an example. See, the incarnation is not just something that Christ has done on our behalf, that God has done. It is something that he has modeled for us. The incarnation, the word becoming flesh, is something that ought to show us how we do ministry in our lives now. I mean, I think if we're honest, there is a temptation always to do ministry in the way that we prefer only. Not incarnational type ministry, but the ministry that we are a bunch of people who love our preferences. If I've been around people very much, my kids, every friend I've ever known, one thing I've learned about people, everybody is weird, okay? Everybody has quirks to them. Everybody has preferences for no reason at all. We don't know why we like this. We don't know why we like that. We just do. This is who we are. We are a preference-minded people. I think about my little son. You hand him a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, he opens it and licks both sides clean, okay? That's how he prefers to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I don't know why. It's disgusting. This is what he does. I think about my brother-in-law, Mike. He goes to McDonald's every day of his life. He orders a medium coffee with 12 sugars in it. Preference, to each his own. I don't know why. My wife loves pumpkin pie, hates pecan pie. I say, why? She says, pecan pie consistency reminds me of frog guts. I say, thank you, okay? That's great. You've now ruined it for the whole family. Preference, I don't know why. All of us are quirky. We all have these, our tendency is to think about ministry and to think about the way that I prefer and to stay within the preferences of ministry that I want to do. These are ministries that I like. This is my preference. I'm kind of quirky in this way or that way, and I'm just going to do this, and this is going to be ministry for me. Some of that's good. God's wired you. Run with that. Some of it's not good when we look back and we realize that in Jesus' incarnation, there are principles there that we need to be following, that we need to look to Jesus and say, how do I do ministry in the world? You have done ministry to me. How do you do ministry through me? It is governed in some sense by the way that Jesus was incarnated on our behalf. You know, when we think about Jesus, we always be thinking about the way that he saves us, the way that he motivates us, and the way that he examples to us. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 1, Paul said, Jesus is an example. He said, follow me as an example as I follow Jesus' example. I think sometimes in our stream, we would consider ourselves to be a gospel-centered church. With all of that means, I'd love to explain that to you. But in a gospel-centered church, sometimes the tendency is to realize that Jesus motivates us and saves us, but he's not an example to us in any way. No, he is. And one of the ways that he is an example to us is in the way that he incarnated himself on our behalf. And there's things that we ought to learn for that. I've got a few of them right here. That's going to be the way that we close our night, all right? One of the things that we ought to learn and model, one of the examples that we ought to have from Christ, is that he was willing in his incarnation to heal what was most wrong in society. Remember, Jesus comes to heal the broken, beat up parts of who we are. Following his example, we ought to be a people who go out and seek to heal the broken, beat up parts of the city that we live in, of Greensboro, North Carolina. When we look at Christ, he eats with sinners, he sits down with the downtrodden, ultimately brings healing here on earth. Are we that type of person who is looking at his example and saying, hey, where can I participate in the brokenness of the world? Where can I bring healing? Where around me is the world screaming out for help? Is there a chance that I might be able to answer the call? Are you involved in the broken parts and the hard parts of ministry here in our city? Is your small group involved? Is there ideas that you have for ministry that you are just not acting on? Mercy Hill, you know, I hope, if you've been around very long, that I will shoot straight as I can about the Bible, and I will definitely shoot as straight as I can about our church, where we knock it out of the park and where we have a long way to go. In 2014, I truly believe that what I'm talking about right here in terms of the organization from the top down about the way that we as a church attack ministry in our community has got to change and has got to become more organized, and it's just got to become better. I know that there are dozens upon dozens of you, our church, that have been motivated by the gospel, are in the community, working in the community, working in the broken parts of this city, and I praise God for that. It would be my worst fear to create a system at this church where you ever felt like you had to come to me or to our pastoral staff to get involved in the community ministry that you feel like God is putting on your heart. You're motivated by the gospel, you go and do. You see Jesus wanting to heal the most broken parts of the world, you go and do the same. But with that said, and there are dozens of us that are involved in world relief, in prison ministry, in pregnancy support. But with that said, in 2014, I think that you ought to be seeing from our church, from an organized level, from a top-down level, more of an organized effort in these areas, and I think that you are going to see it. I would love for many of you to be a part of that. Tonight, every single one of us will go home, and there are people in Greensboro, North Carolina, that will sleep outside in the rain. Tonight, there are women that will be bought and sold in this city. There are children who are on their third or fourth or fifth foster home without a family. There are people without homes. There are prisoners that will get out, that will go back to the only community that they know because there is not another one there extending an open hand. Church, if we look to Christ and we realize what he has done in our life, how could we not look around at our church and say, God has given us a young, vibrant, healthy church? Shame on us if we are not following his example in that, all right? Another example that we can follow in Christ's life is this, being ones who empty ourselves for the sake of others. Philippians 2 talks about this with Christ. Philippians 2 shows us that Jesus does not consider it robbery to be equal with God. He is equal with God. He is God. But he has taken on the form of a bondservant. He has taken steps back on our behalf. Is there any area of your life, be it your money, your time, your energy, where you can say, I am taking steps back in where I could be? My house could look like this, but I've taken some steps back. My career could look like this, but I've taken some steps back. What I drive could look like this, but I've taken some steps back. In order that I might empty myself for the sake of others. Last week, Pastor Bobby, 2 weeks ago, Pastor Bobby talked about this. He talked about decreasing in order that Christ might increase in our lives and in our community, in our sphere of influence. We can decrease and let Jesus increase when we realize that Jesus decreased for us, that we might increase. All month long, we've been talking about an offering that we're doing. You're going to hear more about it in our announcement time, called Generous December. It's an offering where we're not the money that comes in doesn't stay at our church. It goes out. International church planting in North America, community ministry here in Greensboro, out into the community. I don't know if you've been able to do anything for this or thought about it. Is this a way you might be able to take some steps back and empty yourself in order that that others might hear? Right now where we're at with Generous December, y'all, we're on track. We got 9 days left of Generous December, and we might hit a goal that we set that was very high. My prayer is that we will hit the goal because in the next 9 days, people will be motivated. They will look to Christ. They will see an emptying for them, and they will be willing to empty themselves for others. Another thing that we see about Christ is that he brought signs to the world. As Jesus comes, and this little baby, he is a light. And as he grows up, he brings signs of healing. Heals people that are blind. Heals people that can't walk. He does these things in the earth so that people will get a glimpse of the kingdom that is coming. I saw an article this week. There are 80,000 streetlights in the city of Detroit. 40,000 of them do not work. Where are the 40,000 that do not work? Where do you think? Probably low-income areas. A lot of crime happens where the 40,000 streetlights don't work. The darkness. Jesus in these signs, what we want to do in signs, being involved in the community as we follow his example, is shine lights. Boom, boom, boom. There's a kingdom that is coming. Y'all, the last thing that I wanted to mention as we wrap it up is this. Another example that we follow of Christ is that he does it all for joy. Hebrews chapter 12 tells us that as we run the race, we ought to look to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who basically has run for the joy that was set before him. The example that we have from Christ is running this race for joy. Incarnational ministry for joy. It reminded me of an illustration that I've told you guys before about a guy who was a missionary in South America dealing with people who had lived a very hard existence. They were primitive people, really a Stone Age people. They had no contact with anybody from the outside world, knew one language, very violent, very hostile, dealt with death on a daily basis, lived hand to mouth, very rough existence. He lives there for 2 or 3 years, never really sees a smile, never really sees tears. And you live that hard of a life, you just are numb. He finally breaks in and shares the gospel with them. And as he's sharing the gospel with them, he gets to the part where God takes on the form of a man, comes in the flesh in order that he might save them from the very things that make the existence pretty harsh for them. And as he comes in, as he shares that, he sees both joy leaping and he sees tears. People he hasn't seen cry in 3 years, they see this and they're overwhelmed. Do you and I retain that type of joy in our lives? The way that we will be motivated in order to go out and to mission and to incarnate ourselves in a sense in Greensboro, North Carolina, is when we get this type of joy. It's joy over the mission that will give us the ability to adopt the mission. Joy over the mission that Jesus has missioned to us. That will give us the ability to adopt the mission and take it to Greensboro, North Carolina. Let's pray.